I'm delighted to be here tonight to launch the Origin Speaker Series in the cozy confines of Artifact Coffee. This gathering is intended to elevate the conversation about food, its origins, and what is happening around our food system in the Chesapeake Bay watershed. We started our first restaurant, Woodbury Kitchen, with a commitment to local sourcing and now work closely with more than 60 different farmers and growers throughout the region. We supply our four restaurants and our canning and butchery operations with meat, eggs, grains, fish, shellfish, cooking oil, cheeses, and produce, literally everything we need to feed our guests. The hope is that this series will shine a light on the work that farmers and producers are doing in our area. The conversation is being held monthly at Artifact, our coffee shop in the heart of the Woodbury neighborhood in Baltimore. Tonight's program, our 10th in the Origin Speaker Series, will feature a conversation with Bernie Herman, the department chair and George B. Tyndall Professor of Southern Studies at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Tonight's discussion will focus on the food, foodways, and culture of the Eastern Shore of Virginia. Herman, along with Tom Gallivan, Mills Wiener, and Heather Terry Lusk, founded the ESVA Foodways LLC. Their collective goal is to create one job for one person so one family doesn't have to leave this area. And now I'd like to turn the program over to Dana Slater, the producer of the Origin Speaker Series.
Good evening, and welcome to our 10th Origins event at Artifact Coffee.
Yay, Dana!
Thank you all for coming. We appreciate it. And so without further ado, I just wanted to welcome Bernie Herman to Baltimore, our own Bernie.
That guy took my name.
I know. So we're going to feel our burn tonight here. Just going to read a little bit of Bernie's intro. He's the department chair and George B. Tyndall Professor of Southern Studies. He joined the American Studies Folklore and Art faculty in 2009 at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill.
Correct.
I think we have some folks here from the University of North Carolina.
Go Heels.
Our Heels.
Excuse me, I'm hard of hearing.
So he joined their faculty after a distinguished career at the University of Delaware, where he taught in art history, history, urban affairs, public policy, and material culture studies, and co-founded two interdisciplinary research centers on material culture and historic preservation and architectural documentation. That's a lot of words. But what brings us here tonight is really probably nothing to do with any of those things, right?
That's true.
So Bernie is interested in the Eastern Shore of Virginia, the foodways, cultural, and history of that part of the world. And he's founded something this year with a few other folks that I'll mention called the Eastern Shore of Virginia Foodways, Inc. And their goal is, to quote Bernie, to create one job for one person so one family doesn't have to leave the Eastern Shore of Virginia. So that is his goal with this. And just wanted to talk about his partner, Tom Gallivan, who couldn't be with us tonight, but will be eating a lot of his food later. So all the oysters, all the clams, and anything else?
That's it.
That's it from Tom.
That's from Tom. And his other partners in the foodways are Mills Wiener from Chatham Winery and Heather Terry
Lusk
from the H.M. Terry Company. So I think without further ado, I'm just going to turn everything over to Spike. And thanks for coming. Enjoy yourself.
Thank you. Yeah. Thanks, Dana, as always. And thank you to this dedicated Origins family that we have here coming out with the maniac bear running around the neighborhood. And, it's great to see you all. It's great to see some new faces. And I really feel like Origins is on a roll. We've had a couple, I think the last couple of these have been amazing with William Moyes Weaver here. And Bernie is somebody that I can't tell you how excited I am to talk about the Eastern Shore of Virginia with you. We met on one of the trips that I took with some of the cooks and chefs from Woodbury couple years ago now, and going down to see Tom Gallivan, who is an amazing guy, a waterman who works both sides of that peninsula, both on the ocean side and on the bay side, growing clams and oysters. Tremendous guy, and we pulled up to the boat there, and Tom was talking to this guy, and it was Bernie Herman, and that was the first time I'd met Bernie, and Bernie went his way, and we went out with Tom into the water in on Hog Island Bay, and it's just one of the most spectacular places you'll ever see. That whole 100-mile shoreline is just it's barely well, at least now, I guess in the past it has been inhabited, but at this point not so much. And Bernie had given us his phone number, and as we made our way back down onto land and then down the peninsula, we made a point of stopping at his house, which is one of the most spectacular settings I've ever seen for anybody. I don't know why you ever leave, and I guess...
because I have to support my habits.
You have to come to places like this. And I think that might be as good as any place to start, because what I saw there, A, the most spectacular little setting, what I imagine a lot of what the Eastern Shore and the Bay would have looked like 200, 300, 400 years ago. Bernie took us out and showed us where he had planted oysters in the water, the oysters that I think are still growing, I hope. He showed us the grass shrimp that he had seined out of that same water, and we were just blown away. There's a lot more that I'd love for you to talk about, but why don't we start with where you live and this amazing place that you call home?
Well, first of all, thanks for inviting me here. I'm really delighted in any opportunity to speak to the Eastern Shore of Virginia, not to be confused with other Eastern Shores that may confuse you, is a pleasure. I have a long history on the Eastern Shore of Virginia, and actually when I was little in the 1950s, very little, we lived on the next neck north, Occohonic Neck. And as they say there, sand gets in your shoes and you just sort of never get over it. And so we moved away and we would come back periodically. And there came a time that Becky Herman and I were sort of looking around and thinking about, you know, what the future might be for us. And we started to think about how we would reconnect to the Eastern Shore of Virginia. And we were out and about, as they say, and we were in the back of a car with a realtor, and I'm looking at the pamphlets, and I'm saying, I didn't know Westerhouse was still standing. I thought this had disappeared into the dust around 1980. But sure enough, it was there. It was one of the very first buildings I photographed in my life as an architectural historian. And we went there, and it was as I remembered it, except for it didn't have trees growing through the roof. So that was how we ended up there. It's a wonderful place. That neck has been settled by Europeans and Africans, certainly since the early 1640s. And before that, it was home to First Peoples for thousands of years. And all those traditions still survive within the foodways of that community. Wow. And as I was getting into the idea of being there, I also remembered what it was like in the 50s and started to think about oysters. And I looked out at the water, and there were hardly any oysters. And so my friend Dave Shields, who's a great food historian, wrote Southern Provisions, was visiting. And Dave and I have known each other since 1971, and we usually get together in the summer and write poetry together for a week, and then we go our separate ways, and nobody ever sees these poems, thank God. You know, there are some things that shouldn't even be animated enough to have a stake driven into their heart. And those poems are in that category. So we got tired of doing that and started to go out and mudlark, which is what you call it, which is sort of you go around in the marsh and you're looking to see what's happening out there. And we stumbled across a couple of old oysters. And so over the course of an afternoon, we picked up 300 scattered adults. And that began a project which has now led to 7 hand-built oyster reefs and a naturally reproducing population that I imagine is now pushing 200,000, 250,000.
Wow. So you could probably see the difference in water quality and that's had that effect in your bay?
They certainly have an impact on water quality. My oysters would have a very small impact. But the fact is that oyster cultivation has come back in a very big way to the lower eastern shore of Virginia. So that one of my neighbors grows 60,000, 70,000 for table every year. There's another grower across the creek. I'm not sure what his volume is. And then there's the oyster ground at the mouth of this creek where they are pushing 7 million.
Wow.
So these are enterprises that are really making a big environmental impact. And it's one of the very few forms of agriculture or aquaculture which actually improves the environment right. as opposed to damaging
it. Yeah. So let me ask you another. One of the things I saw at Westerhaus was, and it's just two words, but they conjure so much, fig library. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. Is that figs are very much a part of that landscape, and you think about figs as one of the great cultivars. I mean, this is the plant that Christ cursed into barrenness. I mean, you think it didn't work out for him, but, you know, that's how it goes. The fig is native to the Levant and enters into the Mediterranean in antiquity and ultimately finds its way to the Americas, coming up through the Caribbean and then getting established. The earliest records I've seen of figs being cultivated are actually in coastal North Carolina in the 1720s. The figs that I'm interested in are figs that have century histories and that I can work out those histories on site. And all the figs that grow in the eastern United States are clones. It requires a highly specialized wasp for a process known as caprification, which is sort of fertilization of the fig. And what we think of as the fruit is not a fruit at all. It's a flower, and when you cut them open, what you see on the inside are hundreds of blossoms. And they have a tiny opening in the base of that flower, and it takes a specialized wasp to go into that opening and fertilize that set of flowers that are inside of the thing we eat. That animal apparently cannot survive in our climate, and so the figs that grow are clones, which means that you can find plants, cultivars, that are genetically true to type that can be hundreds of years old. All you have to do is go out and figure out what those histories are and talk up a lot of folks. And we've had some real success in this. So one of the figs that we just listed on the Slow Food Movement's Arc of Taste is the Hog Island fig, which is the fig that Grover Cleveland had for dessert on his re-election in 1892. And this one we have really dead to rights. It survived on Hog Island in the ruins of the Coast Guard station garden, where there's still a few other cultivars that we want to rescue and reestablish. And we went out there, Tom Gallivan and I, and it's one of the few places in the summertime is you put on waders to walk on the land because the insects out there, I mean, it sounds like BBs hitting you as they, you know, run into your waders, you know, they're boink, boink, and they just bounce right off you. And we went out there and got these, and then working with another friend, Bill Neal, we began a set of rootings of these things. And so we're starting to reestablish these along with other varieties like the figs that Randolph Higbee rescued after the hurricane of 1936 and brought ashore with him from their island home, or those that surrounded the house of the Crumbs who were associated with yet another island family. The idea of a fig library, though, is if they're clones, is it exists so that anybody can come and take clippings. They check out figs, and then they root them, and then you begin to reestablish them, and each one of them comes with a history of the site with which it is associated.
Great. It's amazing. And you'll give those clippings to anybody that finds their way to your door?
Absolutely, as long as they don't chop down the whole thing. That would be sort of counterproductive.
Yes, and we're going to have some of your figs in our dessert tonight.
So that's true.
Dried figs.
I wasn't sure I was going to be able to get them here, to tell you the truth, is that when I looked at that shrink-wrapped pack of dried figs that I put up last summer, and I thought about the TSA and those scanners, I began to think, will they mistake figs for C4?
Apparently not, right?
Well, I'm here.
Yes.
What's so great about figs? I mean, I'm a fan of figs and everything, but I guess I'm sort of talking about their connection to Hog Island and all the other locations that you're trying to make this fig library for. So if you could speak to that.
Well, that's two questions. One is what's so great about figs is, I mean, you could go to D.H. Lawrence and engage that literature. But you can also think about them. I don't know how many of you all eat figs, but I'll tell you, in the summertime when they are warm, it is if you have ingested the season, and it suffuses your entire being with this kind of moment of sugar and the aromatics of flowers. It's extraordinary. So there's that. It's a start. The other part of that is that figs were very much a part of the diet and historically, and one that really reached across all classes. So it's one of those things that you find has very strong association with the foodways of the poor, often African-American community in that part of the world. And it is those associations that are so powerful, so that it becomes the history that you eat. And in each time you consume that history, it's a form of remembering, and you become that place in that moment.
Wow. but it's...
You were asking, is that I'm from the South Carolina Lowcountry, and there are people who've come from what we call off, who have bought some of the plantations, and they have realized that the best way to reinvigorate the landscape around the plantations is to continue to grow what was grown originally, in many cases at home in the Lowcountry, it's rice. So I was thinking about the figs. It's like that's what was grown there for hundreds of years. And so to keep up the ecoculture, it's continuing to grow the figs as it is continuing to grow the rice at home. Is that correct?
It is. I'm not sure what the impact figs may have on the quality of soil, but they have certain advantages that are very important. One is you do not plow a fig orchard, so you don't have wind erosion. You don't irrigate. These things are, I mean, it's really hard to kill a fig. You've got to go out of your way. They don't require fertilizer. What I do is I mulch mine with washed up salt grass and oyster shells. They like salt. So it's one of these things that is incredibly productive and yet not disruptive of the landscape. But there are the other grains and things that people grow. One of the most extraordinarily engineered landscapes in the United States are the rice plantations of the Carolina Lowcountry. If you look at the evidence that's contained in the property survey maps from the late 1700s, those drawn by Joseph Purcell, for example, is that you see that that entire intertidal area is diked and dammed and drained, and their reservoirs. I mean, that is a landscape that is sculpted for productivity of a particular type to the nth degree. The larger question is, I think, are the foodways ecologies that rise up around that. For example, a great favorite of the diet in the Lowcountry were bird pies, in particular bobolinks. Which ravaged rice fields, and so they're very much part of that that world. The other point that you bring up, I think, is the real damage that monoculture has done, is that to grow soybeans and feed corn and cotton and not much else can only be bad, because ultimately it's a form of extractive industry. It's robbing the soil of its nutrients. And in a place like the Eastern Shore of Virginia, or even in parts of the low country of South Carolina, is those soils can be very thin and drain, and nutrients just go into the aquifer. First of all, it's not very good for drinking water if you keep fertilizing those fields over and over again. But the other thing is that it's not good for the genome, is that there is a narrowing of biodiversity. And as we move closer and closer toward patenting large areas of the genome in terms of agribusiness, it's crucial to keep this diversity within the food system. And that's the work that Glenn Roberts does with the Carolina Gold Rice Foundation. That's the work that David Shields is pushing in Southern Provisions. It's the work that Spike and everybody here at Woodbury Kitchen promotes in terms of how they source their ingredients and how they think about their preparations. It's not about fine dining. It's about the future.
And for us, you know, the future starts, our future is going to be a lot based on some of the cooking that happened in the Eastern Shore of Virginia, a style of cuisine that you've called surpassingly plain, but it's such a cool starting point. I'd love for you to be able to talk about that because it's inspired us. It's inspired, don't worry, we've kind of gone, I mean, part of the point is to start somewhere, start grounded in a tradition and a history, and see where it takes us, which is what our dinner is going to do tonight. But I'd love, for me, it was a revelation to taste and you know the ingredients and the some of the traditional dishes of the Lower Eastern Shore.
One of the things I've been working on is recording interviews with growers and home cooks and all kinds of cooks.
And so, just I should say that you are the guy I think that wrote the definitive treatise on how to fry a spot. Which is 25 pages of it's a page turner. It's amazing.
Well, that's because my job is to really bring local voices forward. You know, it's not me writing that history. It's me working with folks to bring that history together in a way that speaks to the depth and richness of local memory mm-hmm. and long-term practice. But there are these dishes. You think about signature dishes or signature cuisines. You know, we were talking about South Carolina, Low Country. It's going to be shrimp and grits. Shrimp and grits has undergone a kind of apotheosis from being something that was pretty basic to something that is. There you go. It was breakfast. And one of these things that has just been elaborated and embroidered and become quite extraordinary. A lot of those gumbos from New Orleans, you know, began that same sort of a one-pot meal history. Well, the Eastern Shore of Virginia has those, too, and yet they're things that you never hear about. Oyster pie is one. Clam fritters. Now, there's an art. Giant pone is one you've probably not run into. Sweet potato yeast rolls, some of you may have encountered these over time. Salt fish and pancakes on Sunday, various fish stews. All of these things exist. Now, the seasoning profile historically is just four categories. Salt, and often you don't have to salt things because it's already so salty, especially if you're eating seaside oysters. Black pepper, and the earliest reference to black pepper I found was actually the winter of 1649, but that's another story that also actually raised very interesting questions about the social practice and etiquette of cannibalism, but we'll leave that aside. there are rules, folks, in case you need to know what they are in a moment of desperation. There's some sort of sweet, usually a syrup of some sort, molasses or a sorghum, maybe honey. And then there's a savory, which is usually an animal fat, lard, along those lines. That's the historic seasoning profile. Things like nutmeg are much more limited in their circulation early on. Yes, there's a question here.
So I can't let you go on without asking you what giant pone is.
Oh, giant pone. Now, if you talk to lots of folks, you will always hear things that you just go, what is this? And I was having a wonderful conversation one morning with Sarah Jaztak Burgess, who actually grew up in Lewis, Delaware. And she was talking about when she was a girl during the Great Depression, that there was a huckster who would pull a wagon through the community. And her name was, I believe, Hannah Mary Burton. And she would sell slices of a giant pone. And this is a overnight, twice-cooked corn pone, or a corn cake, that's exceedingly dense, probably good enough to use as a radiation shield in a dentist's office. Yeah, that kind of density. I mean, you've all had that pastry at some point in your life, and you go, you know, this is good for protection from bad things. So she talked about this, and it would be cut in slices, and you could either pan fry it or steam it, and then it was served, usually on a Sunday breakfast. Well, it turns out that it survives in certain families in the Lewis area, and that it's still used not in the black community, but in the white community around the Christmas holidays. I started to think about what the origins of this might be, and that there was a cookbook published in 1889, The Housekeeper's Companion, in the village of Annancock, Virginia. And there it is. There are directions there from the 1880s on how to make this giant corn pone that was something that could be slow-cooked, kept, and then eaten on that special occasion or theoretically through the week.
Soft crabs are something I just saw coming into season down there. What's your favorite soft crab preparation?
Well, it depends a lot on the soft crab. And it depends on what you're looking for. You know, I tend to like Buc-ee's, which are when they start to go a little hard again, or a Buckram crab, and I like those a lot. The best preparation I've had has nothing to do with the Eastern Shore of Virginia, but is made by a chef down in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, which is, I taped this. It took him 30 seconds to make this. And it is flash sauteed in butter with some herbs and then Pernod. And is just has all the respect of the sea, but then with that sort of lovely sort of quality that Pernod brings to something as a seasoning. Soft shells where we are, you know, you fry them. I mean, but you know, you would do that with just about anything you could lay your hands on.
Right. Just if it came out of the water.
Came out of the water if it came beside the road.
So what you kind of said earlier is that you see the cooking of the Lower Eastern Shore, the Eastern Shore of Virginia, as maybe ready for its to have a moment of change or evolution. You know, I think you were using shrimp and grits as kind of an example of a dish that had undergone that. You know, for me, what's one of the things that's really intriguing and exciting about food where you're from or where you are is that it's very, very much defined by place. It's these ingredients. There's not a million things. There are some really cool things that happen there. The figs are one of them. The fish and shellfish from both sides of from the bay and from the ocean are incredible. What do you think's next? You know, if we're ready, where do you see this going? We've got this kind of plain or tradition of plain cooking, limited ingredients. What would happen next?
Well, you know, if you think about tradition not as something that is conservative or static, but is the cultural process of making sense of the world. That's what tradition does. And people constantly inventing rather than holding on faithfully to some mainstay is the next step involves an engagement with tradition in that sense of invention, that sense of excitement. there are two dimensions for this. One is to bring those foods and preparations to folks, as they say, they're from away. Baltimore would be from away, just in case you wanted to.
No, I get that.
Okay.
Every time I go down there, I understand that.
Very good.
Yeah.
All right. So you're catching on.
Yes.
Excellent. So part of this is sort of, you know, creating an awareness of these extraordinary ingredients. The other thing, though, is to also create an awareness of these ingredients and preparations at home. So this last winter, we piloted a 7-course dinner with folks there who are in a position to really spread the word and begin to help. I mean, this is the poorest county in the state of Virginia.
Wasn't always so, though, right?
No, it was one of the wealthiest agricultural counties east of the Mississippi right up into 1929 or so. And then there was some sort of financial disaster. And we've lost population every census since 1930. Mm-hmm. I mean, you think about that, people just being pushed out, going elsewhere. Probably the greatest casualty, I would have to say, has to be the African-American middle class has taken the heaviest beating in all of this. So you've got to really work with folks to, you know, it's about respect. You know, it's a respect for what people do and how they do it. It's got incredible narratives that go with it, is that food is not just about the things you make, the things you grow, and how you cook them. It's about the conversations that superintend a kind of communion. And this is a place where conversation really continues to matter a great deal. And folks get together and they talk. And how many of those narratives are framed around food is remarkable. Even the court records, which are the oldest continuous court records in the United States, they're unbroken from 1632, are filled with references to food and the making of food as evidence which gives truthfulness to testimony. That, you know, right, we were in the kitchen pounding a spell of hominy. You know, it puts you there in that moment. I dined with the Werowance, who served me a collop of venison. You know, those sorts of accounts are really about that place. And so it's the conversation that defines culture, which is lodged in the tangible and consumable reality of food.
You know, one of the things that when I was down there and talking to people, and you realize that so much of this knowledge is contained in the people and not anywhere else. And a lot of these folks are older, not going to be around for much longer. This knowledge is going to be lost if it's not shared. And one of the things that you've done, I think that's one of the coolest things that you do, is the oral histories. The one about Spot that I talked about, I think you did a really cool one about eel, that was, right?
Oh, yes.
And I'm just concerned that, you know, in this age of the internet where everything's available, that, you know, aside from court records and things like that, that a lot of this knowledge, this experience, and this built up, this shared kind of treasury of how to cook and how to eat this way is going to be lost. Do you see that as a threat?
I see it as changing. I mean, there's some real forces at work. My favorite comment about this comes from H.M. Arnold up at Bayford, the old Oyster House, who still fishes, and he says,
I just met him. Yeah.
Well, you know H.M.
Yeah.
And H.M. says, you know, I used to be able to sell fish, but nobody wants them anymore unless they're square around. You know, there's some truth to that. But I also find myself interviewing people in their 20s. You know, it's not sort of chasing the past, it's chasing the present, is what the job is. And when you start to talk to folks about these things, the most common response is typically, I hadn't thought about it that way. And so it's just getting folks to talk out loud and making the record, and then making sure that you return the record. So that when I write something, When it's in manuscript form, I go back to the people I spoke with and I read it aloud to them and incorporate their edits in these final pieces. I get as many copies as I can of anything that gets printed and just pass them out. And, you know, I'll get into a pickup truck, say, down at Red Bank or over at Willis Wharf, and darn if there won't be a copy of a Journal of Southern Cultures with the story of Theodore Pede's turtle party in there. And I go, whoa, well, that works.
So it seems like, so as somebody who's a fan of like the narrative side of this stuff and tying it to place, there's a huge movement, you mentioned David Shields, of the Southern stuff. You've got, you know, sort of New York and New England, who's always had a big voice. But when I move down to this area, it feels like we're not hearing the stories of this area. So, where do we find them? So there's voices for elsewhere, but I can't find the voice of here, including, you know, Eastern Shore, either side. But the voice of the Mid-Atlantic seems to be absent.
I don't think it's quite as absent as that, but I take your point. You know, we certainly don't have a garden and gun speaking for us, which might be useful. But there is a lot of work that goes on and a lot of work that gets out there. I think of the work, for example, that Elaine F., who's here tonight, who's the work she's been doing on Smith Island, and the first oral history publications on the islands came out, I believe, in the 1970s that were based on interviews. But I take your point, and I think that we have, and this is a gross generalization, but I think we've just not been effective in paying respect to what it is that we have. And I don't mean we who've been here for three centuries or we who've been here for 50 years, it's we who are here now. You know, and I think as it sort of, it's learning the distinction that. It's also a very, very complicated region. You've got those massive German settlements and Quaker settlements to the north, and, you know, I think of South Jersey as being part of this larger cultural mix. You've got areas such as central Delaware, which Kent County had the largest free African-American population in the United States on the eve of the Civil War, and that's the land where the fish peppers flourished and that you brought back. You think about the diversity of the Chesapeake, and the fact is that, you know, it wasn't just John Smith, and it wasn't just slaves. It was much more complex. And I think that complexity has flummoxed us to some extent. You know, I'll give you an example. There is a case in 1647, I believe that's right, where the Dutch boy Sneer was found dead in a cornfield where he had been sent to do the duties of a scarecrow. That was his job. He was an indentured servant who was from the Netherlands, who was here and who was trying to just sort of move forward, and his job was that of scarecrow. And the court case goes on, and people talk about coming from milking and everything. But the moment for me, the punchline of this is at the end, where the neighbor went in, who was an Englishman, went in to the quartering house where the Dutch boy Sneer did dwell with the African, the Spaniard, and the Irishman. And I think about that moment, and I think about two things. What language did they speak? What food did they eat? And it's that complexity that I think has eluded us and in some ways has obscured actually just how distinctive and how powerful the traditions are of the heritage foods of this part of the world.
God bless you, Bernie Herman, for all that you do, and knowing that it's a kind of an artificial border between states, you know, there's kind of a big ditto factor for us in Maryland. In defense of Maryland and our oral history, election. I just wanted to let you know that as your state folklorist for a mere 22 years, we've been collecting through MarylandTraditions.org, and I invite you to go online and to find some pretty remarkable and wonderful and many food-related interviews, along with videos shot by photographer Edwin Remsburg, that really bring to life many of the traditions, you know, from Smith Island, from the Blackwater marshes, and actually ham, you know, stuffed ham of Southern Maryland. And I invite you to come and sort of meet Maryland Traditions as, and I think this might be the 14th annual Maryland Traditions Folklife Festival on June 4th on East Avenue at Eastern at the home of the Creative Alliance at the Patterson. If anything, the number of oral histories are, you know, just kind of, you know, since the bicentennial have just kind of, you know, multiplied and multiplied and multiplied. And the secret, I think the hardest part is finding them. And, you know, we'd be happy to help you, you know, find more. But I think that website is a great place for you to start.
Yeah, I would agree. The one thing I would add, it's one thing to find voice. It's quite another to give voice. And it's mining that incredible reservoir of memory and bringing it forward that is the challenge that's out there now. But Maryland's been in the vanguard of folklore field-based research, since before the bicentennial, since I'd say at least 1970, 71 or so.
So you've done a lot, you looked at a lot of old cookbooks. You told me about one that had 100 or so recipes for oysters, but it had 50 or so recipes for the pea crab.
Two.
And I think most of us have seen pea crabs, maybe in oysters, and kind of looked, but that was an actual ingredient in some traditional cooking.
Absolutely. Is that actually the story about the oysters is pretty funny, and this is, I guess, maybe just to me, is that I found a 1907 newspaper article in the Raleigh, North Carolina paper that was written by, who was the historian, Elaine, who did the old houses of Mob Jack Bay and all of that, but he was Earl. It was an article by Swepson Earl, who had been appointed the commissioner of the shell fisheries of the United States. And it lists 100 oyster recipes by name. No recipes, just the names. I'm looking at this. Well, you know, this is the digital universe. How hard can it be to find 100 recipes? Well, we actually found about 90 of them. The problem was we found about 250 additional ones, is that there were all of these out there. And in these accounts, these other ingredients would show up. And one of these was the pea crab. It turns out is that they were very carefully set aside and stored in stoppered bottles and sold in the fish markets. And you could make them in a puff pastry or in an omelet. And now they're seen as a nuisance in the shucking houses. So I've gone to the local shucking houses. Now I've got them saving the pea crabs and throwing them in the walk-in freezers for me. What? Oh, you don't know pea crabs? Oh,
that's why they're here.
Does anybody here know pea crabs beside me? Say, tell them what the pea crab is.
It's a little clear crab the size of your
pinky
fingernail. And I don't know, if you shuck a bushel, you might see one or two. I mean, it depends on the waters they're coming from. But it's a rare thing, but it's a cool thing. And they're symbiotic to a degree with the oyster. And you see their clear see-through, and then you can usually see their row, their orange eggs in there.
And they're really actually very interesting. You're right.
Delicious. They taste like a kernel of corn.
They taste like a pea crab. There are actually two species of these. There are pea crabs and oyster crabs, and they have the same habit. But just so you know, it's only the female that lives in the oyster. And they have an almost translucent shell, and they are about the size of a small marble. They seem to be located with particular oyster environments. So that where we get the most are when somebody brings oysters over from one of the shucking houses, oysters over from the York River. It seems like every other oyster's got a pea crab in it. We hardly ever see them with the oysters that we harvest. But they are considered to be good luck, and they were once a delicacy. But what I learned recently is that the purveyors of oysters, the live shellfish trade in places like New Fulton in New York, if they start getting oysters with pea crabs, they actually cancel out those growers or those harvesters because it has totally become out of fashion.
Tragic. If only they knew. Yeah. There were 50 ways to cook a pea crab.
So I have a comment and a question. The comment was back to voices locally. There's on 103.1 FM every Sunday morning, Voices of the Chesapeake, 8 to 10 or 9 to 11 with Michael Buckley that talks to people from all around the Chesapeake region, watermen, et cetera, and it's a great kind of oral history of our region. Something else for the gentleman up front. Herman or Bern, can you talk about the PEDS Turtle Party? I would love to hear some insight into that event.
Theodore PEDS Turtle Party. There are two social events that formally defined the season that were, if you miss these, you clearly were not a person of consequence. The first of these was Pede's Turtle Party. Now, Theodore Pede lives up in the African-American community of Hare Valley, which is right next to the white community of Franktown. And he would throw, he had some health issues, and so he doesn't do this anymore. The last one was about 2 or 3 years ago. But he would throw this party, and everybody who knew would show up, and you would bring things sometimes. Sometimes people just showed up. And it would be his family, and they would spend 2 days cooking for this. And the centerpiece was snapping turtle. Now, to get enough snapping turtles is a job that requires a network. And Pede had a network. There are people I know had Pede on speed dial. And they would see a turtle beside the road, a great big old turtle, and they would speed dial Pede, and Pede would say, "I'll be right there," or "throw it in the back of the car." I don't know if you've ever thrown a 20-pound snapping turtle in the trunk of your car. You know, if you sort of get that far, the real issue is getting it back out. So, you know, because they get in that trunk and they get around there with the spare tire and the nets and, you know, whatever else you happen to be carrying around and, you know, like the baby seat that you should have gotten rid of 10 years ago. And, you know, the next thing you know, it's got, you know, a turtle sitting in it. So we get these, and he butchers them and then saves them up, and then there was the turtle party. And there would be turtle gumbo and fried turtle. But he'd also prepare another dish, which is near and dear to the palates of people in that part of the world. And these are marsh hens or rail birds. These are the birds that were, their eggs were harvested in the tens of thousands. Audubon himself talks about one day going out and harvesting 7,000 eggs. You know, this you just go, whoa. And this is a bird that, the best way to describe them in flight is if somebody threw a rubber chicken at you. They have that kind of ungainly, squawking flight about them. And people go out and they would push up on these things in the tumps. And they were hunted all the way from the Delaware marshes down through the Carolinas. And what people would do is they would make pies with them. They would make stews. And so people would make rail bird and dumpling stew. Or my favorite was rail bird liver and gizzard pie, which Jeanette Spady, before she passed, very kindly shared the recipe. The problem is that to get enough rail bird liver and gizzards is you are in clear violation of every federal statute that is still active.
Too bad. It sounds really good.
Not if you're a rail bird.
I guess not. If you're talking, when you're talking about these pies, are we envisioning what I'm thinking of, this pastry enclosed filling? Is that what we're talking about here?
Yeah, these are pies. Sometimes they would have lattice tops, sometimes crust tops, sometimes they would be open. But it's a pie and a pie crust, yes.
And is there any particular reason why you think that's one of the kind of the signal dishes of this area, region? Why that came to be?
Well, it certainly has a very old European tradition. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's where it begins. It's also a place where you have a number of these dishes which are in some way or another descendants of one-pot dishes. A pie is a one-pot dish. The advantage of those is, when you think about it, particularly amongst poorer households, is if you make those dishes, a pie, whether it's an oyster pie or a railbird pie, if you make something like black duck and dumplings, any things that are one of the many variations on fish chowders or fish stews people would make, is what it does is it spreads the ingredients equally throughout the dish, so that everybody at the table gets their proportion of those ingredients. And that's a crucial thing. It also becomes a way in which you can use, particularly if you are poor, you can use things like backs, or you can use small birds, or other things which are not those those culinary artifacts of the roast. This is something that exists in a very different trajectory. And so I think those pies fall into that category of one-pot dishes.
Thank you so much. I was a kid who thought my food grew in a grocery store. So just thank you for sharing your knowledge. I'm big into bridge-building work in culturals and socioeconomics. Can you describe a dish that you've seen in this region that has actually brought cultures together? Recently in Baltimore, we've had some pretty bad race riots, and I'm kind of in the center of the work there, but can you describe a food that you've seen that brings cultures together?
Oh, you ask about dishes that really bring people together and bring different practices together. And there are a number of those. I think not so much of a specific dish, but of networks of ingredients that bring people together. For example, hominy, which speaks to the deep histories of First Peoples, but often prepared in ways that resonate with West Africa, that in turn resonate with ways from the different parts of Europe. And those things have continuing lives, continuing histories. They're very much part of that world now and continue to be part of that world. So that if you think about it, I don't know if any of you all recollect that story of stone soup. Is that, it's stone soup that brings people together, because everybody brings something to add to that pot. And those are what these dishes often do. And they have histories that speak to the deep practice of doing that.
Is there a hominy dish that is typical of this of Southern Virginia or Virginia's Eastern Shore?
Well, I can tell you the hominy dish I want to make.
Okay.
This is so cool. In 1649, which, as everybody knows, is a spike of the Little Ice Age, is Colonel Henry Norwood gets marooned off of Assateague Island and gets rescued with his party by the Kekatanks. And he is taken to the werowance of the Kekatanks, where they are nursed back. And there is this moment of this meal that he describes. And there's enough there that we could actually begin to recreate this. And it's a kind of stew that is hominy, wild turkey, oysters, and mussels. Now, the reason I mentioned the spike in the Little Ice Age is there are two species of mussels that are out there, two varieties. One is a mussel that is very common now, and these are those ribbed mussels that often anchor marshes, which if they grow in dynamic, clean waters can be very strong-flavored but tasty. The other ones are those shiny black-shelled mussels, the blue mussels. Those grow in colder water. We see those in the very early spring, late winter, as blooms, and we'll see hundreds of thousands of those little blue-black mussels that might be, oh, a half inch long before it warms up and they die. When it was cold, those mussels grew close to shore. So that's two different flavors, and I'm very curious to try to reproduce this dish. You know, how would it have been seasoned? Well, we know that Colonel Henry Norwood had a pound of black pepper with him, but that would have been him. And so I'm very interested if he seasoned this for the Werowance and his court.
Wow.
It would have certainly have had various herbs in it, but this is the dead of winter, and so it would have been things that would have had to be dried. Could be sassafras, you know, the deep origins of filet. But it's something to experiment with. And I just thought it would be great to have the Werowance's dinner once more.
We'll be on it if we can find some mussels.
Hey, I got mussels.
Are there Eastern Virginia, Eastern Shore recipes for beer or mead or ale or any of those things that I know the folks up in Delaware at Dogfish Head are quite adept at recreating ancient fermented brews, and I wonder if you've explored that.
I have, and there are not recipes, but there's enough evidence to get a sense of how people did this. And we know in the 1600s is it was hard ciders that people drank far more than they would have consumed beers. There were particular times of year when they would mash apples, and that was a task that was undertaken by both men and women. And then there was a cidering time, so this is going to be in the fall, and then the cider was fermented and casked and then was sent around, or people would buy it or trade for it, and they would get these casks, which I imagine were pretty small, you know, maybe 10 gallon, 15 gallon. So, and so they would live on these or drink these through the cold season. There was distilling as well. There are small stills that are owned and show up in the court record. But it would all have been really, except for the cider making, pretty small scale. So what I'm trying to do now is to find somebody who wants to go down that path to bring that back. There's the Accomack apple, which Lee Calhoun in Old Southern Apples mentions as a lost apple. Well, my experience has been is things are more often misplaced than lost, and that you just have to get out there and really start to look around for them. And I'm very interested in trying things with pears. There are a lot of very old pears, and they are more resistant to things like fire blight than apples and quinces.
Were there quinces down there?
Oh, yeah.
Ugh. Any more?
Yes.
Hands on some quince. What are you working on with Wills and Tom?
Yes. We created the Eastern Shore Virginia Foodways LLC last winter. And it's an unusual LLC because we don't want to make money. What we want to do is make jobs, and jobs that are meaningful for the people who live there. you know, my friend Sandy Lloyd up in Philadelphia, when we used to do historic house work together, would convene us to talk about what the interpretation would be for a historic site. And she would turn to us, she'd say, "So what song does this house sing best?" And I began to think about that, along with Tom Gallivan and Heather Terry Lusk and Mills Winter, is what song does that place sing best? And the song it sings best is about the one that is about what people harvested, what they grew, how they cooked it, and all of the rituals that surround the consumption of that world. And so that's what we did. We created this, and it's got two goals. One is to create awareness for folks who are not from that part of the world and may never have been from that part of the world. And the other thing is to create awareness there. It's often the case that what is familiar gets forgotten. And part of our job has been to make the familiar visible, to bring it forward in ways that are not about chasing some antiquity, but really about showing respect for what defines people's lives. And nothing defines them more than what they eat.
You're reminding me of white potato pie. Did you see that?
I tend to think of white potato pies and bean pies as more up around the area of North Delaware and Philadelphia, you know, maybe down in parts of, you know, they may be in Baltimore, I don't know, but that's not what people made. They didn't make white potato pies. Now, what they made were sweet potato pies. And I'll tell you, you know, you think Martin Luther got into it with the church when he pinned the rules on the door. You get into it with sweet potato pies, and, you know, it's, you know, the Inquisition looks like light. The recipes about sweet potato pies are legion. And my favorite is the recipe for Haman's sweet potato pie, which is a cultivar which actually came in from South America and the Caribbean into southeastern North Carolina in the 1850s, seems to have entered the Methodist circuit and found its way up to the eastern shore of Virginia. At one time, it was widely cultivated and called, Dave Shields has recorded this, the Southern Queen was highly desired. It's got a couple of disadvantages. One is it's sort of like, you know that avocado green of the 50s and how, you know, reviled that is? You'd want to bring that back, you know, with the color of a Haman sweet potato. The other thing is that they tend not to travel very well. Mm-hmm. And when they're cured, they seep sugars that are so intense that they actually look like a black grit or decomposition on the skin. But in fact, that means they're ready. But people will throw them away who don't know them. But this recipe for Haman sweet potato pie that I collected from the late Laura Dennis, whose mother ran the Plantation Cafe in Cape Charles, Virginia during the Great Depression. And little Laura Dennis's job was to pull the pie wagon through the streets of Cape Charles for door-to-door deliveries on Saturdays for the Sunday dinners, is that she gave me this recipe and I've made this pie, and it's pretty amazing. But it does, at the end of the recipe, there's this handwritten notation. Pie may be slightly green and very, very rich. Both are true.
Great tangent. Can I just, in reference to his question about food for community, you know, the crab feast, to me, is it. You know, it's where people sit around together, they share something from the middle of the table, and it's a total, you know, communal experience. However, when I'm in fishing communities and I say I want a steamed crab, you know, with pepper, you know, with Old Bay, they look at me like I'm nuts. So I wonder if you, you know, where you, if you found the tradition among the traditional communities, and certainly the you know, the crabbers and, you know, the watermen of the Eastern Shore of Virginia.
I mean, people eat steamed crabs now, and it's sort of a party thing, but it's not common. Is if you're going to steam crabs, is you pick them out, and then you would make crab cakes or something along those lines. What is more the sort of gathering food, or used to be, were fish and fish fries. And people really loved to get together to fry spot. That was a big one. And then the all-time favorite were toads. And, you know, can't beat a toad, let me tell you.
Which is a sugar toad, a fish.
A puffer.
Yes.
A green eye.
Yes. Not a toad.
A swelling toad.
Yes. Which we have at Woodbury right now, if anybody's hungry. The sugar toad. And I think that's going to take us to supper. And which is, with Bernie's consultation and guidance, our chef here, David Spiegel, has created, I think, what's going to be a memorable supper. Everybody's going to get an oyster pie. We have individual oyster pies, which I'm really proud to be serving. And hopefully they are part of this new tradition. And
they'll get figs.
We'll have figs for dessert. Before we even sat down, we had some toast and things like that. But we also had oysters from Church Creek, which runs right into your
It's a parallel creek.
Right. And these are really interesting because Tom Gallivan, who we've talked about a couple times, is farming these oysters behind the Chatham Winery. We don't have the Chatham white wine, this incredible Chardonnay they grow and make there.
That's because I drank it all.
There's not that much to start with, and it's all out right now.
It didn't take me very long.
Well, yeah. I got to taste that wine, that the Chardonnay, maybe the last bottle that you didn't get to, along with their oysters, and it was just spectacular just a couple days ago. We had so that was the Church Creek oyster that they call the Church Creek Corks that Tom's growing for, I think, for the winery. So that was about as hyper-local as you could get, as the grapes are grown about 100 yards away from the creek. It's a spectacular place and spectacular winemaking happening down there. Was there any, just real quick, was there any tradition of wine grape growing and making before these guys were
doing Not it? That we know of, right. Although there were lots of wild grapes that were out there.
Uh-huh.
But I do want to add one thing
sure.
that,
yeah.
here, is that Tom and Mills and Heather and I have been working on the kind of projects that would really create awareness. Mm-hmm. And one of these that we're developing is what we think of as the Culinary Exchange Program, in which we would invite somebody not unlike yourself to forage and spend a couple of days and then do a pop-up dinner there that we would, you know, have some folks, you know, who could pay for it, but bring other folks who couldn't so that, you know, they would have scholarships. But then 4 to 5 months later is to take all those ingredients and bring them to you or to another chef in a different part of the region and begin to get that conversation moving forward.
That's cross-pollination.
Yeah. And next time we'll see about getting a Hog Island sheep here.
Mm.
They're tasty.
So dinner is served. We do have wines from Chatham, two red wines that are spectacular, the Cabernet Franc and the Vintner's Blend. We have a big, we're doing kind of a riff on a kind of a clam roast. So we've got clams from Tom Gallivan, kind of steamed with a little white wine, sausage, potatoes. Really all we have right now. It's going to be delicious. Some torn up hearth-baked bread, and then some salads, and then, as we said a couple times, the figs for dessert. So, Bernie, thank you. This has been amazing.
Well, thank you all. Thank you very much.
Thanks again for joining us tonight at Artifacts for our Origin Speaker Series. With thanks to Dana Slater for producing the program, Hannah Reagan for her masterful coordination, and particular thanks to Mark Eldridge for recording this evening's conversation. We're grateful to be partnering with Heritage Radio in Brooklyn, New York for creating a home for the Origin Speaker Series.